Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from North Rim Bank, supporting educational programming across Alaska that inspires children of all ages to learn and grow. NorthRimBank.com.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Steve Cleary. If you've ever driven the Hall Road past Coldfoot, you may have seen the signs for the Tulik Field Station just past Galbraith Lake. For more than 50 years, scientists have been braving the cold and dark winter, as well as the hot and mosquito-filled summers, to do field research on a variety of projects, all with the goal of inspiring an understanding of the Arctic from the ground up. The scientists who come to Tulik are pursuing that understanding in a variety of ways in the challenging and changing Arctic environment. Studying all aspects of the Arctic while climate change accelerates is one of the goals of Tulik, which is the largest scientific research station in the Arctic. We'll explore what life is like and what's in store for the next 50 years at the Tulik Field Station. That's ahead on Outdoor Explorer.
Consider a gift of stock to Alaska Public Media. You may avoid paying capital gains tax and receive a deduction. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/stock or contact your financial advisor.
This is Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Steve Cleary. I'm delighted to be joined today by three members of the staff of the Tulik Field Station. We have Sindonia Brett Hart, Principal Investigator and Science Director of the Tulik Field Station, Seth Beaudreau, who has worked for the past 15 years as a naturalist at the Tulik Field Station, and Chad Deisinger, Station Manager for the Tulik Field Station. Welcome to all of you, and thanks for being on Outdoor Explorer.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, we're going to start our introductions with Chad, who's the manager. Chad, can you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up at the Tulik Field Station.
Yeah. My name's Chad Deisinger. I grew up in Pennsylvania, moved to the Pacific Northwest in 1997, where I lived for a few years before moving to Alaska in 1999. And then was working for Alaska Department of Fish and Game for a few seasons before I found out about Tulik, and yeah, started working for Tulik in 2005.
Great. And what are your major tasks as the station manager?
Day-to-day operations, overseeing the staff, being the point of contact for researchers to field support requests and delegate tasks to our staff, generally just trying to solve problems and come up with solutions to things that the researchers need and challenges they're facing. Just making sure our trucks get launched, freight gets unloaded, buildings get cleaned. So yeah, just day-to-day operations.
And I'm sure it varies a lot over the year, but how many people are up there now getting ready for the summer season, and what's the winter like? What's the difference in staffing?
Definitely a much different feel from summer to winter. Right now we have 30 folks here in camp, and that's mostly support staff. So we've got a construction crew that is up here from our support contractor doing upgrade tasks and some construction projects. And then as well as our support staff, there's only 4 researchers in camp right now, but that'll be ramping up next week as we have groups arriving on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday of next week.
Great. And from your website, which we'll definitely link to in the show notes, it seems like quite an operation. It seems like a little city up there. Can you give us a quick outline of like how many buildings? Like, would you liken it more to a college campus, a small Alaska village? What's your footprint up there?
Yeah, it's more of a camp feel, I'd say, than a village. But there is a mix of both tent structures, so soft-sided structures, as well as hard-sided buildings. We do have a couple of substantial structures. Our kitchen, dining hall, office building is a newer building, along with our garage. We have a very large, Arctic capable garage. And so those are really two of the most substantial buildings. And then also quite a few labs. What are we up to now? Maybe 12 labs, and that's also a collection of hard-sided buildings that make up our labs, but we also do have tent labs, soft-sided buildings. And it's spread out over several acres, a gravel pad that used to be a work camp for a pipeline in the pipeline construction era. So yeah, gravel pad that the camp occupies right on the shore of Tulik Lake.
Great. Well, and I'm delighted that we have a couple of the staff that are taking advantage of those facilities up there. Seth, could you go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about how you got to Tulik and what your work entails up there?
Yeah, my name is Seth Boudreau. I grew up in Massachusetts, was always fascinated by wildlife, and I started working in Alaska in 2003. After getting a wildlife and fisheries biology degree, started working as a fisheries technician, did that for a few years in Southwest Alaska while working on migratory bird projects in Central and South America during the winter. And through the fisheries work, I met Chad out on a fish counting weir on the Kinnecktok River, learned about Tulik, met another few folks eventually in Fairbanks who worked up here. That's how I got to know this place. And I've been working as the naturalist here since 2011. So I cover a lot of ground in the Tulik area every day, looking for what's going on with wildlife and migratory birds and the resident species, taking photos, and then coming back in the afternoon and writing about it for the daily naturalist journal entries that I do on the website. And the goal of those entries are to just put out kind of a daily summary of what species are seen, what's going on with weather, some photos from the day. And that's something that's looked at by people here in camp who don't get out as much, by their families back home, and by just the general public. Anybody who's interested in wildlife on the North Slope can take a look at that.
Yeah, that's great. And does that go year round? I feel like when I first had the idea of interviewing you all, I had seen some winter ones. Are there other folks that do that during the winter time?
Yeah, I'm here from mid-April through the end of September, basically. And so that's, you know, trying to be here for any time of the year when migratory birds are here. But aside from that, when I'm away, other staff from the Environmental Data Center at Tulik take care of the Naturalist Journal. And yeah, so it goes 365 days a year, ideally.
That's great. And as I mentioned earlier, you've got an impressive website. There's lots of cool videos, a few obligatory mosquito ones that I viewed because I know about the mosquitoes up there. But let's turn to your the third colleague we have today, which is Sindonia Brett Hart, who is the Arctic Research Lead up in Tulik. Let me make sure I get your title correct, Sindonia, and introduce yourself, please.
Yeah, I'm Sindonia Brett Hart, and for Tulik, I'm the science director and the PI of the Cooperative Agreement, which is a grant with the National Science Foundation that funds the base operations of the station. I'm a professor at UAF, and my research has involved tundra vegetation and ecosystems and response to change over the last, I guess, 30 years almost. I started working at Tulik in 1993 as a volunteer on a pluck, which is a harvest and separation of plants and soils to measure biomass and soil characteristics for a graduate student at the time, Sarah Hobby, who's now a very distinguished professor herself. I got involved with Tulik management in about 2002, I guess, when I became the associate science director working with Brian Barnes, and then I became the PI of the grant, which means I write the grant and I supervise our senior staff at Tulik. And so my role with Tulik has grown over the years. I think it's very helpful that I have my own research project. So I have spent a lot of time at Tulik many long summers, as well as, you know, it's very interesting, actually. You know, it kind of is different than the rest of my academic portfolio of teaching and doing research to work with the fabulous staff. And I'll just mention, put in a little plug here, that Seth's Naturalist Journal is the most cited webpage that we have. So gets the most hits, actually. I think other than the landing page. So lots of people look at it and really appreciate his high quality photography and his observations, his thoughtful observations that he's developed over the years. Tulik hosts people from across the country and around the world. It's not just a Alaskan field station. We have about 60s, I think this year it's 67 projects, but some years it's like 70 to 90 projects that are funded mostly, but not exclusively, by the National Science Foundation. People who are working at Tulik and cover a wide range of disciplines, everything from kind of basic ecology and understanding the plants and animals on the landscape, and then how nutrient cycling happens and how the ecosystems kind of communicate with each other through these chemical signals, to things like hydrology, geology, and then we have a robust group of space physicists who don't come in person very much, but have instruments that are operating during the winter. And they're tracking space weather at the very edge of space. You know, that information is really helpful to understand, like, whether satellites are going to collide or not. And they look at the aurora, they look at the winds at the very edge of space. So it's really, we host a wide variety of disciplines. Right now we have about 4 international projects that are funded either with EU funding or from national funding from other countries like Sweden and Italy. And it's really a wonderful experience to work at Tulik. In my experience as a researcher, you know, coming as a postdoc, and then many people come as actually undergraduate students, and they work for a season or two, and it really changes their life. You know, we've got people who started as a student, and now they're professors themselves. So it's really transformative, because, you know, you're sitting in our dining hall and you're rubbing shoulders with all these people that you wouldn't necessarily have a chance to talk to at your home institution. And they're telling you, you know, about the work they're doing and also their career paths. And it's really helpful and transformative for young people. So it's a wonderful place to work. And I really appreciate the chance to have been involved with it all these years.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. Thank you for that broad overview. And it's very interesting to hear that you started out as a volunteer in 1993. I've been perusing your website, and I've been perusing your website and seeing the projects. And I did want to and thank you for mentioning where the bulk of your funding comes from. The National Science Foundation, but it's interesting to me, because I sort of suspected there would be studies about bear and beavers and dragonflies, which I saw on your website, but I didn't expect the NASA ones, or the Swiss Polar Institute, or there's another one from Harvard, and just the breadth of different disciplines that are out there. And so maybe you could share a little bit more, Sindonia, about kind of the day-to-day work. Like, what does that young naturalist, that young scientist do when they get up to Tulik? Like, what happens at a pluck? What do they have to bring? Or are they being kind of instructed in the studies that they're doing?
Yeah, well, I will say that in terms of bringing stuff, things have really changed since I came up as a volunteer long ago. And we provide a lot more information now than we used to on our website to help people be prepared, because conditions in the Arctic are really different from what a lot of them are used to. So we give them a gear list that they should bring, and we tell them, you know, about the conditions and stuff. And part of being happy in the Arctic is being, like, protected from the mosquitoes. So, you know, people really appreciate wearing that bug shirt and those rubber boots, you know, pants that the mosquitoes can't bite through, and having enough warm layers. We also, in recent years, have developed a gear closet, which is a wonderful innovation that really helps early career researchers who haven't been to Tulik before, who might show up thinking that that fleece they have is warm enough, and then discover that when they get up here that they need something more. So we have all these items that have been donated by our community, and people can check them out, you know, for a season or a year. We have boots, we have jackets, we have a lot of stuff like that. In terms of the actual work, it kind of depends on what type of work you're doing. But if you're in one of our terrestrial ecology groups, you're probably going to spend a lot of time walking across the tundra, possibly collecting plant samples or soil samples or insects. And then oftentimes these tissues that you collect have to be processed to make sense of them. So you need to weigh them, dry them first and then weigh them, maybe separate into different tissue types. That's what basically plucking involves, is separating plants and soils. But there are also people who are doing things like catching bugs and counting how many bugs they get at different times of year, or for example, tracking bird activity through automated, basically recording units. There's a big group that's been working on that. We had a group that was working on understanding the dynamics of voles and their effects on vegetation. And so they were actually trapping voles and then in one experiment, adding voles to one area and taking them out of another area. If you're an aquatic person, you're going to spend a lot of time on either the rivers or the lakes. And there's a wide variety of lakes in the Tulik area. So they offer a lot of different characteristics that are nice for lake researchers to compare, you know, different depths, different types of organisms that live there, including different fish species. And so those folks are often collecting a lot of water samples. They're often out in boats and they're filtering the water samples to understand the chemistry. And maybe they're also catching fish. In fact, we recently had a campaign, or maybe they're about to start. Well, they're fishing early in the season, always catch and release, to understand what the dynamics of the fish populations are at the beginning of the season. And then at the end of the season, when the fish migrate upstream into their overwinter habitats. There's our grayling, for example, spend a lot of their summers in the rivers, but then they have to get into deep lakes, deep enough that there's a layer of oxygenated water at the bottom so they can survive the winter, because many of our shallow ponds freeze, you know, basically all the way to the bottom or so close to the bottom that there's just not enough air in the remaining water for the fish. So they have to make it back to their safe havens before the winter comes. And I'll also mention, actually, we recently had a project that just completed where folks were actually looking at winter dynamics with fish and other components of the aquatic ecosystem in these hot springs that are not incredibly hot by our standards, but are hot enough that they stay unfrozen during the winter. And the name of that project was Freeze or Famine, right? Because on the one hand, you'd think it would be really bad to be frozen in the winter. On the other hand, in the winter, there's no light. So there's no primary production by plants that provide food. And so these guys might be active and have a warm metabolism and have nothing to eat, right? So this project was kind of tease out the dynamics of that. So yeah, it was a great project and very interesting. So yeah, there's just a wide variety of things to study. And so as a student, you get a chance to be involved with all that hands-on field work and also lab work and data entry. There's a lot of data entry. Some data are entered automatically, but there's a lot of data that are just entered into Excel spreadsheets in the labs. And so you get a taste of all the different activities. And many of the students also do a small independent project, and then they'll present on that. We always have our undergraduate showcase when they give oral presentations on the projects they've been working on over the summer. And that's always very exciting to have the students talk about what they've been doing. That usually happens in August.
Wow. Well, that's great. Chad, I'm going to flip it back to you. I've had several friends work in Antarctica, though I've never been. And it strikes me maybe the logistics and the planning and just all the things that you have to deal with are somewhat similar. Obviously, one can drive to Tulik, but it's not easy. But do you see any similarities there? Is there some crossover there? Are there people that frequent both places?
There sure are. Yeah. I mean, I've not worked in the Antarctic myself. But we have many of our support staff here at Tulik, as well as our support contractor, the construction crew I had mentioned. Lots of those folks will work in Antarctica, you know, in other parts, other times of the year, and then, you know, come up here for spring and fall construction campaigns, work during the summer on our staff doing support. So there are many similarities, but like you said, the logistics of getting to Antarctica are a little bit more challenging than here, but still, you know, isolated, confined in extreme conditions. So it has that that similarity for sure.
Right. And speaking of spring, when does it come to Tulik? I'm sure it varies year to year, but I did a trip up there where I was surprised in July when I got back to Coldfoot. I think it was close to 90 degrees, but I bet spring comes rather late up there. What's the general melt time up there?
It varies quite a bit. We've been having an extended spring this summer for sure, or this season for sure. And May has had mostly winter-like weather. The lake ice is usually off by mid-June. And we do start to get hints of spring in April. You'll have a few nice days where it, you know, warms up, the sun is out, you know, warms up relatively speaking, and you know, things might start to melt just slightly, but then we can slip right back into winter conditions for, you know, weeks during May, which has been the case this year. Although right now the sun is shining and it's, you know, above freezing, so it feels pretty pleasant out there, and got a lot of slushy, wet mud and you know, wet slush out on the pad. So things are looking like it's finally moving towards, you know, early summer, late spring.
Great. Well, thanks for that. If you're just joining us, this is Outdoor Explorer with Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Steve Cleary, and today I'm talking with three folks from the Tulik Field Station way up north. We're grateful to have them here today. And Seth, I'm going to turn it to you next as somebody who studies birds. I don't know a lot about which migratory birds would be coming through or near Tulik, but it sounds like you get around a fair bit looking at birds. Can you give us a few birding highlights? Why would a birder head up that way for to check some boxes on their life list, for instance?
Well, there are about, I think, over 140 species that we've documented in the Tulik area. It's a really incredibly important area for breeding birds in the summertime, many of which are coming from as far away as Central and South America, even the southern tip of South America, all the way to the Antarctic Peninsula. Arctic terns are coming from all the way down there, for instance. But it's also a unique spot because we have some species coming over from across the Bering Strait, some species that spend the winters down in Southeast Asia and even Sub-Saharan Africa, for instance. So bird specialties for this area that bird nerds will come all the way up here to see would be like the blue throat, which is a mostly an Asian species whose range just barely kind of comes over into Alaska. They're a really beautiful bird that also does some really cool mimicry of other species in this area, and also mimicking like the ribbits of frogs that they must learn on the wintering grounds in Southeast Asia. Northern wheat ears are coming here from all the way in Sub-Saharan Africa. And all the little Wilson's warblers and stuff that's coming from Central America. So even though you can feel like you're in the middle of nowhere here, it's a place that's connected by birds to a huge part of the globe.
That's fascinating. I had no idea that there would be a pattern that way. I always think of it north-south for some reason. So if you had to put kind of a time frame on it, how long do they spend at Tulik? And then how long does it take to get to Sub-Saharan Africa, if you know that off the top of your head?
I don't have that. It probably takes a matter of weeks for most of these birds to get to where they're going, or to get here from where they're coming from. I can say that I got here a month ago and we had a few days where it got down into the minus 30s. But a month later, I'm seeing thousands of geese every day. A few duck species are showing up, the first few shorebird species, a bunch of types of sparrows. So it very quickly starts to ramp up as soon as the temperatures are getting tolerable. And birds, a lot of them migrate based on the amount of daylight. So they're kind of coming up here whether or not the habitat is ready, which with climate change can create some interesting scenarios in this area.
Well, that was my next question for Sindonia, who's done some, as I see in your intro, some study on the and focusing on the effects of global climate change on at least Arctic plant communities. But Sindonia, can you tell us a little bit about your research and kind of what you've noticed, you know, in the decades that you've been going to Tulik?
Yeah. So we expect, we, the scientific community, expect changes due to climate change to be particularly pronounced in the Arctic, basically because of the patterns of air circulation, the big air circulation cells that are on the Earth that kind of basically, we'll say, kind of concentrate the heat toward the poles. And so we expect the largest changes in the Arctic and the Antarctic, even as there are significant changes also happening in temperate and tropical latitudes. And so what we've seen over the years at Tulik, actually Tulik is a little interesting because it's buffered a bit by being close to the Brooks Range. And so the mountains cause the downward flow of cold air in the winter. And that has kept our temperatures from changing quite as fast as like as is being seen on the coast at Ukiagvik, for example. But still in all, we've seen some pretty big changes in the temperature of the permafrost over the last 50 years. Permafrost is warming at, you know, depth, and then that's translating as well into more thawing events that are close to the surface. Thermokarst, we call them, events where the ice or the frozen ground thaws, and then you get a ground collapse because that structure that was formerly provided by the ice disappears. And that, of course, can lead to changes in the plant communities. We also see, we've been monitoring carbon, water, and energy balance at three sites at Amnaviat Creek over the last, well, since 2007. So that's almost 20 years now. Yeah. And there it's been interesting, actually, that the soils seem to be changing faster than the plant communities are. We've seen some subtle changes in the plant communities, but the depth of the amount of carbon in the soil, which we've seen big carbon losses with our eddy covariance data, but the amount of carbon that's available has been increasing because the bottom is getting deeper, right? So you're recruiting carbon in the mineral soil because the depth of thaw is deeper, and then you're losing carbon in the organic layers at the top of the soil. And that, and those feedbacks of that carbon is being basically, that's undecomposed plant material that's now subject to decomposition, and the microbes are kind of chewing it up and they're spitting it out as CO2 or methane into the atmosphere. And of course, that's a strong natural feedback to climate change by just increasing the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere. And so a lot of the research at Tulik actually is kind of wondering, like, what is the fate of all that carbon? Because that is a natural feedback that we can't legislate away, right? And so it does seem like the ecosystems, at least some of the ecosystems, are losing substantial amounts of carbon, which, when you scale that to a larger scale, is a concerning thing. And the plants are adjusting, you know, they're getting bigger, they're growing more, but they're not growing enough more to compensate for the loss of that sort of historic carbon. But the ultimate, like, trajectories of these changes aren't totally clear yet, which is why it's still a good subject to research. And I think that for us who live on the surface of the Earth and interact, you know, the trajectory matters, right? So how fast the change happens is going to impact how easily we can respond to it. So I think that the research that is focused on this topic is actually, you know, it may not be immediately directly useful, but it's definitely useful in terms of the strategies, right, that governments can come up with to try to buffer these changes.
Right. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you for that. I know that, as you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of data entry and a lot of Excel spreadsheets. And I see on your website that you all have Asana and the Tulik Health Club. But starting with you, Chad, if you have a day off and you want to go outside and explore from Tulik, what would you do?
Well, we've got great options, you know, right out of camp. If you don't want to drive a truck down to the mountains, or, you know, north to some of the foothills north of us, you could hop in a canoe if the ice is off the lake. We do have a fleet of boats here, so you could canoe across the lake. We do have a small foothill of the Brooks Range right on the south side of Tulik Lake that we affectionately refer to as Jade Mountain. And so, yeah, you can get a great view of the Brooks Range from atop that mountain. But if you've got the time and luxury and ability to hop in a truck and drive the half an hour or so down to the mountains, you know, there's just a huge expanse of mountain terrain, alpine terrain to go wander about. The north side of the Brooks Range is so user-friendly, very accommodating to hiking since there are no trees and very minimal shrubs. So it's pretty much, you know, the challenge is just walking on spongy tundra, but, you know, great alpine ridges and peaks to go explore. Yeah, it's really a hiking mecca for, you know, on the north side of the Brooks Range, just because of the ease of moving across the landscape, relative ease, I should say. Distances also, though, are very deceiving. You'll think it's just a hop, skip, and a jump to, you know, get to the base of a ridge and get to the summit. But then when you start moving across the landscape, since you don't have the trees and other, you know, vegetation that gives you better perspective on distances, things that look close are far away, and things that look far away are probably not something you're going to hike to in a day. So, you know, that's another challenge on the tundra with just distances. And yeah, hiking on spongy tundra isn't something that people normally do. It's kind of maybe, you know, equivalent to like walking on really soft sand or soft snow, but it's, yeah, it definitely presents a challenge, and you feel muscles that you don't normally use after a day of walking on the tundra.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was up there a couple summers ago, and we hiked, you know, just before getting to Tulik, we parked right at that bridge and hiked backwards kind of into the mountains, like you're saying. And we kept thinking like, oh, it's a little greener over there, or maybe it's better over here. And it wasn't. So I'm hoping that Seth or Sindonia can let me know the secret to walking on that spongy tundra. But you must do that all the time, Seth. But you're outside most days. But if you do have a rare day off, what's your favorite thing to do up at Tulik?
I still like to get out. My wife also works here, but her work is more centered around the station. So I like to take her out and make sure she gets to spend time in some of the other habitats and have a better chance of seeing a bear or a wolf and stuff like that. And some days can, you know, also be a good time to catch up with family back home.
Great. I will remind you all that this is Outdoor Explorer from Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Steve Cleary, and today we're joined with three staff members of the Tulik Field Station.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
This is Outdoor Explorer from Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Steve Cleary, and today we're joined with three staff members of the Tulik Field Station, way up 370 miles north of Fairbanks. And I was just asking them about what they like to do when they have some free time up there. Sindonia, what's your favorite outdoor activity when you have some time to spare up at Tulik?
Chad, I love to go on Sunday hikes. And I will say that my hikes are probably rather different than his, because I'm slower, I'm older, and I really like to look at the flowers and the plants. And so there is just amazing, beautiful wildflowers in, you know, June and into early July. And if you like plants, you can stop every few feet to take a look at that thing that's blooming. So I tend to not cover as much distance, but I really love the mountains. In fact, I think that for many people, many scientists, as well as staff members, the mountains are a huge draw and something that they remember, you know, long after they have left Tulik fondly. Certainly that's true for me. And we have a lot of, you know, kind of favored routes, depending on your sort of level of energy and what your interests are, that we have kind of, we can point people toward. There's really a lot of wonderful terrain in the Brooks Range, and also just close to the station, as Chad was mentioning. You don't have to go all the way to the mountains to find some beautiful terrain. So, yeah,
I know in June that you'll have an open house up there. So tell us a little bit about the open house. How many visitors do you usually get up there for it? And what kind of activities happen during that open house event?
Yeah, I'll start with that. So we this is a kind of new thing for us. We started it last year. We were having our 50th year celebration, and we thought, boy, it'd be really fun to have an open house because the station isn't really open to people who are just traveling along the road normally. And it turned out to be a terrible weather day, but we still got lots of people who came, and they had a chance to take some walks with Seth and other people from the EDC to learn about the natural world and the research that's happening, see some research plots. They also got to talk to some of the scientists who were in camp about the research that they were doing. Some of them stayed for lunch and got to experience the amazing food that we offer, and to take a station tour and understand about all the, you know, what the different buildings are, and like, and here's our generator plant, and this is how we get electricity, all the things that make us the little scientific village that we are in the summer. And so we're planning to do it again on the 6th of June, and asking folks to register if they want to eat lunch with us, and hoping that the weather will be better this year and that it will be a great experience for people and a chance for them to, you know, maybe if they're like a trucker that drives the road a lot, then they might wonder, like, what goes on at the Tulip Field Station? This is their chance to find out.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And I know, Chad, in your brief bio that I saw, you're working on minimizing the environmental impacts of the remote operations up there. Can you give us a little bit more on that and how your Leave No Trace ethos is being kind of implemented in the day-to-day up there?
Yeah, well, we're always trying to cut down on waste. Obviously, the logistics of getting trash out of here is challenging. Most all of it goes to Fairbanks in our fish totes or our shipping totes. So we have definitely supported the borough's recycling program as much as we can with recycling all the materials that we can recycle with the borough's program. And then also installing some hand dryers in our bathroom so that we're not using as many paper towels to dry our hands with. We have started just this season, finally, we have a composter so that we can compost our food waste from the kitchen, so that we can then bring that back to the university and incorporate that to what they've spread on the flower beds around campus at UAF. But just generally overall, trying to find ways to reduce our solid waste production. And then also with our energy consumption, essentially, you know, fuel oil, just always reviewing what through the winter is our largest consumer of oil, how much, you know, we're burning in different buildings, and trying to consolidate our operations to the fewest amount of buildings in the winter as we possibly can, to try to reduce the amount of fuel that we have to use to run the generators to heat buildings. So it's an ongoing battle. I mean, the logistics of where we are, it would be nice if we could utilize more renewables, but we, you know, there's also the challenge and then the cost of, you know, buying all that equipment to create the renewable energy sources, like, you know, turbines, or we do have some solar, but you know, that only works in the summertime when you know, the sun is shining. But so it's an ongoing project, and hopefully, yeah, we can keep working towards reducing our impact as much as possible.
And give us a few sentences on that shift to winter. Like, when does that occur? How many people are staying there over winter, and how long do they stay? Is it? I assume that the road is open generally, and people can get in and out, though it's difficult. But Chad, how does that operational change happen?
So our main season is from early April, so from the beginning of April to the end of September. And so we call the, you know, essentially April and September are like our shoulder seasons. And then the peak of our summer season is June, July, and August. But by the end of September, we are going into winter operations. I mean, we are, like you said, we're open year round. So we try to keep things as consistent as possible with the support that we provide. But for sure, the number of researchers and projects that are actively working dramatically drops off after, you know, September. And so by the end of September, beginning of October, most of our seasonal staff have departed, and it's mostly just our regular staff. And then through the winter, we do have regular visitation by some projects, but it's a very reduced number of projects. As Doni mentioned, there are quite a few projects that have autonomous equipment out, you know, on the landscape. And so our environmental data center technicians, they'll go out and, you know, do things with projects equipment, but there's not necessarily, you know, lots of projects sending folks up here to do work in the winter, but there are some, and generally every month of the year we have researchers visiting the station. But yeah, through the, you know, cold, dark months of the winter, it is pretty quiet here for sure. Definitely have lots of time for quiet solitude, and you know, we enjoy it. It's definitely a nice break from the summer busyness, and it definitely has many, you know, different aspects to the you know, the beauty of the Arctic, with notably like the extended twilight periods, and you know, the sun goes away, we'll have, you know, our dark times, but there's still light in the sky. You'll have, you know, beautiful earth shadows and alpenglow that extend for long periods of time, and then great aurora, and then just the, you know, the way the sound travels in the winter with the super, super cold air. I mean, the highway, we're about 0.8 miles away from the Dalton Highway. And so in the summertime, you hear the drone of the trucks, but in the wintertime, I mean, it sounds like the trucks are like right outside the building when the temperatures are sub-zero. You know, when it gets to about 40 below, it seems like the noise, just the sound just travels so much more effectively. So, and then the sound of, you know, the dry crunch of the snow and ice. Yeah, totally different world up here in the wintertime.
Well, thank you for that. And if you're just joining us, this is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Steve Cleary, and we're speaking with three members of the staff of the Tulik Research Station. As I mentioned previously, there's really great videos and images on the website. Seth, as a photographer, what keeps you going up there? It seems like you know, from a bird's eye view, I'll use a bad pun, it looks pretty static. It just looks like miles and miles of either beautiful mountains, of course, or tundra stretching off as far as the eye can see, rivers there. But how do you differentiate days and get yourself out there to go look for more wildlife to photograph?
I mean, the bird community is changing throughout the season, as we're right in the middle of a spring migration. So new species are trickling in every day, and I try to get a really good database of the arrival dates for each species, like when the white-crowned sparrow first shows up in the area, for all the species that we encounter up here. And then the converse in the fall of getting kind of the departure dates. So we're tracking those over time. But every day I never know what I might find. One day I might see a wolverine. You know, I've only seen probably 6 or 7 in my 16 years here. Wolves, bears, that kind of stuff is all super special, but also just kind of going out every day and trying to capture some little detail or moment in one of the lives of these species is always, I never get bored, I'll say that.
Well, that's great. I know that some of our listeners would be interested in going up to the Arctic and doing a trip up there. Maybe it's hiking, maybe it's floating. Since you three have so much experience up there, I wonder if you have ideas or tips for people who are thinking about heading up to the Arctic, maybe going backpacking for a few days to a week, maybe going floating on a river. Are there suggestions that you have or tips you would care to share for our outdoor explorers? And Doni, let's start with you.
Well, I guess one thing is just to be prepared, right? So be sure that you have good gear, good, you know, mosquito repellent and or bug shirts and you know, and be prepared too that hiking, as has been alluded to, you know, the distance on the map may not really be realistic for what you can do in a day. So, you know, think about that, maybe start small and then expand as your interests take you there. I think floating is a really wonderful way to experience the Arctic because it's not, you know, quite as strenuous. And there's a bunch of Arctic rivers that are just so beautiful that you can float down, you know, either starting from a place that you can just pull off the road and like do a car shuttle, but also places you can fly into that will drop you off and then you can float down. It's obviously super important since we have a wonderful population of bears that you take care to secure your food and have bear containers and things like that. I think one of the things that's also really nice about the Arctic is that it's not full of trails that are, you know, mandated that you should go here and not there. It's really open for you to explore yourself and find your own adventure. That's something you wouldn't get, you know, in like, say, Colorado. If you're climbing in the Rocky Mountains, you know, there'd be like, oh, you need to stay on this trail or that trail. And it's not true in the Arctic. So it's really, you get the chance to really be out in the wilderness and enjoy it. I think I don't want to give specific recommendations for places, but I would just say that it's really, it's a really wonderful thing to do. And so, yeah, just like start small and then expand as your interests take you.
And how about you, Chad? Have you had any fun adventures away from the field station up there?
I have. I've got really, I'd say, limited backcountry experience up here, but I have had some really fun hiking and pack rafting trips on breaks that I've had from the station. And so I definitely recommend looking into a pack raft. I know, you know, it's like a very common thing for Alaskans to use, but definitely pack rafts open up a wide range of trip opportunities. Because as Doni mentioned, it's just great being on the water. There's so many rivers, you know, in this region, and so you can really put together incredible routes that, you know, have you hiking, and then when you're worn out from hiking on the tundra, you blow up your pack raft, and then you can, you know, sit and enjoy covering a lot of distance, a lot of miles, just by, you know, the current carrying you down the river, and then also just the ability to cross rivers or lakes, you know, using the pack raft. And then I'd say, like, the only other recommendation that I would have is definitely where you set up your camp. I mean, you always want to have a good view, you know, just for the aesthetics, but also so that you can keep an eye on your surroundings and see potential, you know, bears if they would be approaching. But also being on a ridge top or a high point also increases the likelihood that you'll catch some breezes and maybe minimize the clouds of mosquitoes, help keep them at bay a little bit.
And how about you, Seth? Have you gotten to do any fun adventures away from your work world up in the Arctic?
I'm working almost the whole time I'm here, so I haven't done any really big hikes. I don't get super far from the road. I've done a couple float trips over a weekend or something, but nothing major. I think, the immediate area that I survey provides enough to keep me going.
Awesome. Well, we've been remiss not talking about the clouds of mosquitoes. Doni, what's your secret? Maybe it's the bug shirt you mentioned earlier, but how do you, it's torrential up there. How do you keep them away?
For me, it's the bug shirt. So, you know, you want to wear a hat that has a brim that holds the shirt out away from your face and your ears. And then you can feel quite secure, and you just have the kind of ever-present wine when you're out in the tundra, but you it doesn't bother you, right? So that's part of the adaptation. I do remember, I'll just have to tell you a funny story. When I was early in my time that I was up at Tulik, I went on a hike on my birthday, which is the middle of July, kind of peak field mosquito season. And I hiked up to the top of Jade Mountain with some friends. And then I came back and the mosquitoes were so bad. And I was just like, oh, I can't wait to get to my room and, you know, get out of these bugs because the sound was so terrible. And I got to my room and I closed the door. And then I realized that my backpack was covered with like 100 mosquitoes or 200 mosquitoes or 300 mosquitoes, who knows? And then I spent the rest of the night squashing mosquitoes. So that was something that I learned after that. Like, don't just run in with your backpack covered with mosquitoes. But still in all, it's really, it's really amazing. Like, I don't know, you sort of get used to it if they can't bite you. And then it's just sort of like part of the experience, and you just sort of get used to it. I do remember that there was one young lady, she's long gone from Tulik, but she was evidently not very sensitive to mosquito bites, and she would just be out doing field work without any bug shirt at all. And we were just always amazed that she could stand it, you know? She didn't drop dead from blood loss, but she was just cool as a cucumber out there. But most people are not like that. So having a bug shirt, bug repellent is helpful too, especially if you're hiking, because then a bug shirt is hot. But if you don't have a breeze, they can still come after you. Depends on the year. Some years are better than others. And fortunately too, the period of really bad bugs isn't that long. You know, it's kind of like the end of June, basically, to the first week in August. So you have some beautiful time on either end when they're not quite so ever present.
Well, that's a good tip, and I've certainly brought a bunch into my tent, as you did with the thing. That's pretty easy to do. Chad, you got
such
any?
A nightmare.
Yes, it is. Chad, you got any tips for mosquitoes other than being that superhero almost that Donnie was just talking about that was seemingly impervious to mosquitoes?
I do own a bug shirt, but I use it very little. I mean, they're super effective, but I find that. When I'm out, I try to hike faster and keep the mosquito cloud behind me. And you notice as soon as you slow down when they start catching up. But Donnie made the great suggestion, and I've made that same mistake getting into the tent. But yeah, and same thing with when you get back to the road to get to your vehicle, you have to get away from your vehicle. Maybe try and brush all the mosquitoes off you and then like sprint to the door of either your tent or the vehicle and jump in as quickly as you can. But I mean, there's definitely a lot of other besides just DEET, the ingredient in bug spray. They make all kinds of Natrapel and all of these different things. So if you're opposed to the chemicals in DEET, or in most of the bug sprays, you can try different things, but the bug shirts are really the way to go, for when you're just sitting around, not hiking, just because you feel so much more comfortable while you're sitting there in enclosed and in screen, mesh around your head and body.
Well, that's a good point that I didn't think of. Seth, you must have the challenge of being stationary quite a bit and needing to use your hands, because the bug shirt only goes so far unless you can pull it down over your hands, but you'll need those for photography. Do you have special gloves, or what's your secret for being able to take photos when the bugs are bad?
I think you just kind of have to give in to enduring it. And appreciate the shoulder seasons that much more. But I also, like this summer, will be taking a break that just by coincidence goes from late June through all of July. So I'll miss most of it this summer. So that makes it easy.
Well, we're nearing the end of our time today. Donnie, do you want to send us off with either... a study or two, a scientific thing that's either just about done or coming up that you're really excited about and looking forward to at the Tulik Field Station?
Boy, that's a tough question to come up. There's so many fun things, right, that are going on. But I guess one thing that we're pretty excited about is, you know, we're moving to become a true dark sky station in the winter, and that's opening the door to a whole bunch of fun, basically space-related research and astronomically related research. And I think that that's going to be kind of a growth area for us in the future. So we're pretty excited about that. It's so cool all the time. There's just amazing things that are going on. I guess another thing I'd just like to make a pitch here that we're pretty excited about is every year we support a few early career researchers with an award, that the Tundra Award, that allows them to come to Tulik and have user days, even if they don't already have a grant. And we're going to have three researchers this summer who are coming, which is really awesome. And over the time that this program is funded entirely by donations, private donations, a lot from our staff. And over the time that we've been doing this, the 16 of the people, let's see, over half of the people that we've supported so far have actually come back to Tulik with their own funding after getting that start. And so we are really excited about that. And this year we're going to have somebody from Canada coming and some students from UAF. And yeah, it'll be awesome. So,
wow. Well, that sounds like a great note to end on, with a view towards the next 50 years at the Tulik Field Station. So I want to thank my guests, Sindonia Brett Hart, Seth Beaudreau, and Chad Deisinger, all of the Tulik Field Station, for speaking to us today on Outdoor Explorer. I've been your host, Steve Cleary. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. Tobin Shelby is its producer, and the program is edited by Ammon Swenson and Crystal Hyde. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed on the show are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can listen to Outdoor Explorer anytime at alaskapublic.org and in your favorite podcast app. If you have a question, comment, or a topic suggestion, email outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org.